Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to Histories of the Unexpected. Now, one of the things that we've started to do is to take a break from discussing our unexpected historical topics.
A very short break.
To do a series on how to be a historian.
Yes.
Which we found more and more people are really interested in. And as professional historians, one of our missions is to get as many people involved in the discipline of history as possible. So this is part four of this mini series. And what we wanted to talk about was history for children. Our last one was on museums and where to take your children to teach them about the past. And this is more about learning at home, reading. It's about children's history books.
We've done an array of things in the first three. We've talked about how the kind of history we do, how we got interested in history, that kind of thing, and how you interest children. And so we were just rifling through bookshelves of our kids and thinking, you know, there is so much great material out there that makes history exciting and accessible for kids. You know,
I think we're living in a golden age of kids' history.
Totally. I mean, I've been into schools at the primary and secondary level, and kids are excited and obsessed with history.
Do you think they always have been? Do you think this is a kind of a new engagement of history? Are we doing something right?
I was obsessed with history, but then I was probably a bit of a history nerd.
Yeah.
History is being written in a way that makes it much more exciting nowadays. Yeah. And I think there's a phenomenon associated with horrible histories.
Yes.
The books.
And it is some phenomenon.
Absolutely brilliant. They're Terry Deary's brilliant book series, but also the TV series Greg Jenner is involved in as historical consultant.
True. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Greg.
What are we looking at? Horrible histories. The frightful First World War.
I bought my daughter a box set of these for this Christmas.
Oh, great.
Which includes, the First World War one? It's got the woeful Second World War, vile Victorians, slimy Stuarts, terrifying Tudors, ruthless Romans, measly Middle Ages, groovy Greeks, gorgeous Georgians, and awful Egyptians. And what it's done is it's taken those kind of key subjects that would be taught at school and made them really accessible and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a slight problem with the marketing of it, saying it's history with the nasty bits left in. Like, I could show them lots of adult books which have got nasty bits left in.
I mean, if you just open it, the way that it's written, and I recommend any parents or teachers who haven't got into this, buy these for your kids. They are absolutely brilliant. It actually is really good history, packaged in a really accessible, interesting way.
Well, I did some work at the SS Great Britain, and it's Brunel's big iron ship in Bristol, right? And it was a very significant ship from the 1840s, one of the earliest propeller-driven iron bulk ships. It went through a huge renovation, and it was open to massive fanfare. It was all really exciting. And someone said to me, don't you think that you're just dumbing down the history? It drove me nuts.
Dumbing down is weird. It's an odd thing.
I don't know where it's an easy criticism that people throw at history when you're trying to present it to a massive audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And I suspect that it can be, uses a criticism of children's history, because you simply have to make it simple. But I'm certain that it doesn't apply to horrible histories.
No, definitely not. I mean, dumbing down is interesting. I mean, dumbing down for me, it's a really sort of negative phrase. I mean, you are explaining something simply and clearly to a range of audiences who do not necessarily have the kind of historical training and vocabulary and concepts that a professional historian might. There is absolutely nothing wrong with that. The duty of any historian is to be able to communicate something in an interesting and intelligible way.
I think it's a very arrogant thing
to say. It's a really arrogant thing. Far, far worse is the danger when what you do is you don't, it's not dumbing down, it's when you basically change history. And you're not offering the truth as it happened, but you're putting a particular slant on it that has a particular political, religious, whatever kind of propagandist agenda. Mm. That's the danger. It's not the sort of...
Well, one of those agendas can be entertainment, though, yeah, can't it? Yeah. And that's where these books can... you know, flirt with I mean, problems.
I was just leafing through this one on the example of a gas attack in Horrible History's frightful First World War. And I think the thing there is, like, how do you convey to children something that was utterly, utterly horrific? You know, if you think about descriptions of the First World War...
You've been reading some of these recently.
Gas attacks. I've been reading some of them recently for work that we've been doing, or for something that we're going to be doing for Unexpected on the book, on clouds, so clouds of gas. If you have a think of Wilfred Owen's famous poem, Dulce et Decorum Est, where you've got these sort of battle-weary troops returning to the trenches, and then they're hit by this gas attack, and, you know, it talks about the froth-corrupted lungs. It's an image that just sort of, you know, stays with you, absolutely haunts you.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? You know, how do you convey that to kids? And Horrible Histories are aimed at, you know, it's on children's BBC. It's aimed at a sort of broad range of kids. And in the book, this is how they deal with it. It's an order from Army headquarters about how to deal with a gas attack should you be without your proper gas mask. And it says, if you are caught in a gas attack, number one, take out your handkerchief. Number two...
I love the idea of soldiers having handkerchiefs.
Yes. Yeah, I know. I never go into battle without my handkerchief. Mummy has stitched my initials into the corner. So number one, take out your handkerchief. Number two, urinate into the material till it is soaked. So it's fully soaked. And three... tie it round your mouth and nose and breathe through it. I mean, it's something that actually happened, you know. And in a pinch, this is the kind of thing that you could have done. I mean, you probably would have wet yourself when a gas attack was happening anyway. Yeah. So you know, but
put your trousers around your mouth.
You know, it's probably not the first thing that you'd think about, no. Is it?
Calmly take out your handkerchief,
urinate on it. You know, yes.
In complete fear, shivering cold and mud.
But there's a little picture of it here.
What's great about this is that, you know, regardless of all the other stories in it or anything, they've all been chosen specifically because they're entertaining for children.
Yes,
and I have no problem with that at all.
Absolutely. They not only have the book series, they have the TV series. They also have a magazine. My five-year-old broke her arm recently when I
your fault.
My fault. It was on my watch. Getting her plaster changed recently, I thought to sort of while away the time, make it less sort of boring and arduous, I would buy her a magazine. And she chose a Horrible Histories magazine. And it was great. And a five-year-old loved it.
Yeah.
So it's aimed at a young age as well. And I think the key here, it's about wrapping things up so that they are interesting and accessible for kids. Take, for example...
And snapshotty.
And snapshot. Yeah, it's bite-sized.
But this is a real problem with history generally. So one of the things that all historians now will emphasise is how massively complex and messy history actually is. And it isn't as simple as that. So if you take that weed on hanky as an example, then to pull it apart as a historian, you say, well, what do you do if you don't have your hanky? What happens if you're so dehydrated you haven't got any wee left?
Yeah.
What if you're so cold you can't get your trousers down? What if your eyes have popped because of the gas and you can't see anything and you're screaming in agony? What? And it becomes much massively more complicated.
Yeah,
and what did the Germans do? Was that the English? What did the French do? What did the Prussians do? What was the actual response?
What are the moralities of this kind of chemical warfare when we see it happening, you know?
Yeah. And what was people's reaction to it now? Would children That's why really interesting. If you think about the layers of history, would children in 1915 have been horrified by that? Going, oh, you're not going to wee on my hanky. No. Or would they have gone, no, that's completely reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really, really clever point. You know, at what point does it suddenly become, you know, amusing?
Yeah.
And what subjects do you can't imagine, you know, somebody making a joke about as horrific as the Holocaust.
No.
You know, I mean, that's just a, you know, I mean...
But it's also the kind of the reality of history as an academic subject and then the kind of the reality of the Holocaust,
for example.
I remember doing a talk on pirates once.
Yeah.
And there was some entertaining story about Blackbeard setting fire to his beard or his face or something. You know, it was a light-hearted story. And someone put their hand up and said, actually, I'd like to point out that I don't think you should be laughing. Pirates are a very serious problem off the coast of Africa and people are dying every day. Well, we you know, I know, but it doesn't mean that history can't be entertaining and it can't be fun and everyone has to be boot-faced and sour when they talk about it. So my point is that the complexity of it all, the stuff that we find fascinating can come later.
Yeah,
it doesn't. It's
and you're aiming at kids. I mean, an example that sort of springs to mind to make things accessible, but which is historically incorrect, is in the Usborne Book of the Romans, the tiny little Usborne history of the Romans.
You might assume that Usborne are a reliable publisher.
Yeah, and they do brilliant books. They are the first port of call in bookshops. That's your entry into a particular topic, and. I remember reading with one of my kids the book on the Romans and the vomitorium.
Right.
You know, so the vomitorium is the room. I think we've spoken about this in the past.
Did we do the history of vomit?
We didn't do the history of vomit, but we should do the history of vomit. But the vomitorium was apocryphally the room that people would go to when they left a banquet, having just sort of gorged themselves, that they would then throw up in order to then return to the banquet and continue drinking rich food and drinking sort of wonderful wine. Apparently, it was an invention in the 19th century.
Huh.
So it didn't exist. Yet it is in this book because kids will be interested in it.
That's interesting. That's a bit sinister. But it raises a very important question of who writes these really massively consumed books about history. And if someone's up there saying that the vomitorium...
Yeah,
we're not saying they didn't purge themselves after eating too much, because I think that's true, isn't it?
No.
But there was a room called the Vomitorium. I think, you know, it proves to me that the Usborne History Book of the Romans was not written by a professional historian.
Yeah, quite
and
probably.
It's worth thinking about that a lot of these widely accessible books that are often anonymously written are not written by peer-respected professional historians. And that's a big problem.
Yeah,
it's almost like the kids' market is often seen as a slightly softer target, and they can get away with all sorts of things as long as it's entertaining. But certainly that's not the case with horrible histories.
Their stuff is
great. It's exactly well judged.
I think it is. It's so useful for parents getting kids interested in history. Mm. A friend of mine, Jerome de Groot, who wrote a brilliant book on public history called Consuming History. Hello, Jerome.
Hi, Jerome.
Up at Manchester. You would love Jerome, by the way. It's a great book, and he's got a chapter in there where he has a section on history books for children, and he talks about the way in which horrible histories work. And in some ways, horrible histories is subversive.
Right.
So basically, you pity the poor teachers in the classrooms, and teachers do a wonderful job trying to sort of explain things. And I know, as a lecturer, you know, the last thing you want is the sort of the smart aleck at the back of the lecture theatre raising a hand, having just Googled, you know, some fact. I think you're right. You know, what horrible histories is doing is it's arming kids with all these amazing facts.
Yeah.
Miss, is it true that Henry VIII only, you know, I mean, you can imagine one of the kinds of things. Is it true that the Romans wiped their bottoms on leaves? But it's brilliant because
it is brilliant.
History should be playful and it should be.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I find it quite dispiriting and disappointing that a lot of the audiences I come across as a public historian expect their history to be very serious and it's quite important, it's quite dour. And actually, I mean, for some people, history, it's all about oppression, it's all about slavery, it's all about wrongs that need to be righted. And that's fine. Other people just expect their history to be straight and completely straight up and down and quite quite serious and traditional. Yep. I can't think of anything worse, actually. Yep. But I certainly come across more people like that than I do people who think it's a bit silly and a bit fun. And I'm not talking in a horrible histories way. I suppose I'm talking in the way that we deal with history when we sit around and have a laugh and say, actually, all right, well, you can write a history of dust.
Yeah.
Or you can write a history of leaning.
History of dust is very serious topic.
It can be very silly.
No, not done by us.
No.
I mean, I want to be serious for a moment, though, because I think we're looking at a kind of history book that is entirely entertaining. But I think also if you look at the way in which history across history has been taught in schools across different cultures, and you think about Nazi Germany, you think about Stalinist Russia, you know, the kind of history that is taught, you know, in many ways is building those kind of cultural foundational blocks of a, you know, a mindset, a historical knowledge.
I know nothing about that, but I'd be fascinated to read it.
You know,
what were kids taught in the year three of the French Revolution?
Yeah.
I'd love to know that. And during the Reign of Terror.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I mean, you just look at how the national curriculum has changed over the last 30 years or so. You know, as we enter Europe, as we sort of move away from Europe, as we're, you know, becoming more multicultural and, you know, the kinds of sort of global history or British history or, you know, all of that is very influential. One of the interesting things as somebody who's interested in women's history and gender history, and it's something I've been passionate about for years, did my PhD on, is the degree to which women's history is taught and talked about. And I've been doing, as part of a research project, been doing some work with a woman in Sweden, Baroness Alexandra von Schwerin, who has a wonderful exhibition in her castle, as you do being a baroness, on the powerful women within her family. And what's extraordinary is the way in which she's using that as a vehicle to try and change the way in which Swedish society teaches women's history.
Yeah.
So trying to get it onto the curriculum, into textbooks. And I have here a brilliant book that I bought for my kids recently. It's by Bloomsbury, by Kate Pankhurst. Mm-hmm. And I think she's probably related to some of the Pankhursts, so the suffragettes.
Right.
And it's called Fantastically Great Women Who Changed the World. We're so often, what we get is a digest of male sort of historical heroes, but this is...
Who are those?
I will open them up. And so we've got here Frida Kahlo, the painter, Mary Anning, the woman who discovered fossils, Jane Austen, the novelist, or Coco Chanel, Emmeline Pankhurst.
Yeah.
So Anne Frank, we all know about Anne Frank and her diary, and Amelia Earhart, so a sort of an adventurer. and you know, a whole range of people. So it's trying to, it's giving.
That's an excellent
in sort of accessible.
Is that recently published?
It's recently published. Yes, I picked it up at the Science Museum in Bristol.
Okay.
Have you been at Bristol?
Yes.
Brilliant. Science Museum. You should all go. And they have this wonderful book here. And again, it's done in sort of little bite-sized pieces.
Yeah.
So Gertrude Edel, who was a channel swimmer in 1920s, teenage Olympic medal-winning swimming sensation. Coco Chanel, the sort of fashion person. Frida Kahlo here, famous for the unibrow. Have you never seen the film, Frida?
No.
Marie Curie, who we all know about. Mary Anning, there we are, the finder of fossils.
So I've got a question.
Yes.
I'm really interested in things like this. Do you think it's okay to slip in a fake one?
Well.
Like Mary Poppins? Do you think that's okay?
No.
You don't think it's okay?
No, but I am normally...
Do you think it's okay if you slip in a fake one like that, but say in the book one of these is made up? To get people to go and...
If you got people to sort of go and do that. Yes.
Yeah.
I suppose.
You're not convinced, are you?
Well, no. I think I can think about great hoaxes like that. There was that...
There are loads.
There was that book on Nat Tate.
Mm. I'm really into historical hoaxes.
Really?
Yeah. I would like to do a hoax TV programme.
Nice. Just
genuinely make something
nice.
Up. You could reveal it at some point because it's still with playful of what is acceptable, what is accepted, what people believe, where your authority lies as a spokesperson for history. So you can do it in two ways. One is you can tell a pretty well-known story and slip in a couple of fake facts, or you can do a completely made-up story. I think it would be difficult to get past the commissioners, quite frankly.
Nat Tate was the American artist, supposedly dated 1928 to 1960. Which was actually a novel written by William Boyd. And it was written a few years ago. And I remember the way in which they presented it and David Bowie sort of stood up and was sort of saying, yeah, well...
Oh, you invented someone.
Basically invented... Right. I remember Nat Tate, blah, 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 blah. And it totally made up. And then you got all these sort of art critics who were saying, yeah, wonderful work. Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. And total and utter hoax.
And it just takes the authority of someone like David Bowie to say...
Yeah. You need somebody like that, and then suddenly it becomes, you know, it's convincing. You've got that sort of authentication behind it.
Yeah.
What hoax would you do?
I don't know. I am too interested in it to even think about it in a playful way.
Or even divulge it.
To even divulge it.
Otherwise it wouldn't be. Yeah. Flaps.
But before we go on to flaps, I don't like the position as a historian that people immediately believe everything I say. As a historian, there has to be a great deal of qualification. So the broad point here is about being a historian is that this is, it's more or less my best guess. There are some parts in history we don't know what I'm saying. But certainly in TV history and often in books as well, what the publishers want or the commissioners want is straight facts. You can't constantly hedge yourself and say, if you only think about this on Tuesdays and it only happened in Sweden during the Austrian-Swedish conflict of 1633, you can't do that. You fundamentally can't do that in public history.
Yeah.
But that means that a lot of the things that are said in history and are assumed to be true are not necessarily true. Actually, one of the things I don't like about being a public historian, it makes me feel very uncertain and unsettled. And it also gives you a great deal of power because you could say something and you could put it out there on Twitter or on a blog or a vlog. And I could make it up or I could be just talking off the top of my head and it might not be true. And I think a huge warning needs to be given there with this. Even the very best historians, they are working with limited information and it's what they currently think. And they could change their mind. It's completely fine for them to change their mind within a week, within a month.
I mean, that's back to what we were saying about dumbing down as well earlier on. I think the skill of communicating something in a very simple way requires you to distill so much kind of nuance and variation and variety and to be able to synthesize it in a particular way.
Yeah.
So, you know, across Europe, such and such happened. Whereas, Europe as a sort of, you know, much more complex entity, the picture becomes
but the moment you start questioning and questioning and questioning and questioning, it just, the whole thing just falls apart.
Yeah.
But your history does completely fall apart and you end up not being able to say anything about anything. But what I really like, I brought a couple of books as well.
Good. And then I'll talk about flaps.
Okay.
I love books with flaps.
These are...
nice.
So what we're doing is we're talking about this border between fiction or outright fantasy or things that are made up, and history. Hmm. Okay, and I think...
What have you got here, Sam?
Well, these are two of the most inspirational books for me when I grew up. So we have Asterix here. This is Asterix and Cleopatra. I just grabbed it. It is still in the loo by our downstairs loo. It's brilliant. Absolutely fantastic. The introduction, the year is 50 BC. Gaul is entirely occupied by the Romans. Well, not entirely. One small village of indomitable Gauls still holds out against the invaders, and life is not easy for the Roman legionaries who garrison the fortified camps of Tutorum, Aquarium, Laudanum, and Compendium. Still excellent names. And then, you see, if you know nothing about Asterix, I should think lots of people know a lot about Asterix. But the one thing you know is that you have a little kind of adventury person, like a little warrior called Asterix. Then you have this kind of monstrous guy called Obelix who carries stones around. These are the kind of the stones that were used to build Stonehenge and things like that, you know. Yeah. Then you've got a druid, and you've got a chief, and you've got a bard.
Yeah.
Cacophonix, which is the best name, and Vital Statistics, the chief, and you've got Getafix, who makes potions and basically drugs everyone up to the eyeballs. So if you remember nothing about this, you will remember that in France, which might surprise some people if they didn't know that, in France there were Romans.
Yes.
Not only were there Romans, but there were Gauls who were living under Roman rule. Not only that, but Roman rule was not necessarily strong all over Gauls. These are the really important, quite subtle points to make about the Roman invasion of Gaul. Then you realise there are different types of people. No women, unfortunately. Certainly not in this the main list. There are women. In this one, obviously, there's Cleopatra. But you'll realise there are warriors. There are people carrying around huge stones and setting them up places. There are druids. There are chiefs. And there are bards. There are people who sing. There are people who entertain. There are people who are worried about health. There are people who fight. There are people who are in charge. And there are people who live there. And that is amazing, I think. And you don't need to go
Franco-Roman history in a nutshell.
It is Franco-Roman history in a page. And yes. there are... God knows how many Asterix books there are. Someone get in touch and tell me.
Tons.
But just by reading them and getting into them, kids will know those simple, really important facts about the Roman occupation of Gaul. I mean, how cool is that? Yeah. And then this one by Tommy Ungerer, who's one of the most magical kids authors, called The Three Robbers. Now, this little book here inspired two entire BBC TV series, which I presented. One was The History of Weapons, and the other is The History of Outlaws. So it's a brilliant story. It's about these three robbers who do quite a lot of kidnapping and bad stuff. And it's all about it's beautifully illustrated with their weapons. The first of the robbers had a blunderbuss. The second had a pepper blower. And the third had a huge red axe. Hey, what the pepper blower for? In the dark of night, they walked the roads searching for victims. And then this is what they did. To stop carriages, the robbers blew pepper in the horses' eyes. With the axe, they smashed the carriage wheels. And with the blunderbuss, they threatened the passengers and plundered them. Anyway, they do a lot of stealing gold. They end up stealing a child. It all gets a bit dark. But yeah, I've always loved the story, and it inspired me to make a series about the history of weapons and a series about the history of outlaws.
That's where they both came from.
Yeah. And those really appealed to me because they're not... Those appeal to me more than horrible history books.
Right.
I'm much
right.
happier with someone being really playful and making stuff up.
Yes.
But inspiring people about history somehow. So this is all about horses and carriages.
Yeah.
It's about people in castles. It's about strongholds. It's about trade. It's about money, economy. It's about rules. It's about law. It's about people living outside of the law. It's about people living outside of society. It's about homeless. It's brilliant. But it's all wrapped up in a made-up story.
Yeah.
Those two appeal to me much more than...
And historical fiction works in that way.
It does. I think that's, yes.
Yeah.
But sometimes you get confused. I used to think The Hobbit was an actual real history of Wales.
But it's based on Anglo-Saxon England.
Yeah. It's not, just to let you know, The Hobbit is not a true history of Wales. No. I wish it was. No. That'd be brilliant.
Flaps.
Yeah, go on.
Books with flaps.
Yeah.
Are you a fan of books with flaps?
Fan of pop-up books. Is that the same thing? Is that where you're going to go?
Kind of. I mean, they're no pop-up. I've just noticed a lot of books by the Usborne flap book series. And there's this amazing...
They kind of, you remove a flap and it reveals something.
You remove the flap. So, for example, you know, early Britain, and then you can have a look inside. As you can see, this has not been read yet.
It's a sticky flap.
None of the books. But basically, you've got here a early Britain house, an Anglo-Saxon great hall.
Yeah, lift it up.
You lift the flap, and then you look inside, and it's the picture is revealed. And I think what kids like about this, and there's a whole series of these, what they like about it is the ability to sort of explore further.
Yeah. Playing with a book, interactive discovery.
Book on the castle here. This is one of my favourites.
I'm a bit cynical about books on castles.
I'm sure you are, but I bet this would, had you read this before your series
Let
on castles,
let me have a look at this, please.
This would have inspired you. Be careful with it.
Okay, well, I'm not going to read it. What do you like about this?
Well, I like the fact that it has flaps and you can see every aspect of it. This, for example, walled in. And you suddenly open it all up and you can see inside the castle, all the different bits. You can see what it's like flying as a, you know, being a knight and doing a joust and training as a kid and, and go on, critique it now.
No, I don't want to do that. I want to see it was written by someone. Yeah, I don't want to rip holes in it. Anyway, it's very difficult to do. But this is.
Anyway, he likes the flaps.
I like the flaps. They're quite fun. There's lots of things. That all let someone injured from a flying arrow. That's quite good. Does it tell me at least what period of castle this is supposed to be? Is it, okay, so
medieval
we had castle. Yeah, what does that mean? Come on.
Well, medieval.
So there's a great deal of difference
from a castle
built by Henry VIII and.
I know.
Yes, I know. And William the Conqueror. They should have at least given a date. This is a rough idea of a castle in 1230. It looks like a French castle in the mid-14th century.
You should have written this book. You should have written it.
Yes.
Would you have designed flaps?
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
Yes, and pop-up things.
Good.
Yeah, that I'd have had a kind of like a working pop-up trebuchet.
Gosh. Are we done on children's books, do you think? Do we have anything more to say?
Well, just that they're extremely important for getting your kids involved in history.
You know, that after all is what we want with this. You know, we're not looking to sort of force history down people's throats, but there's actually an important social mission here that people should be knowledgeable about the past, and not just the past of their own country, but they should be knowledgeable about the past in, you know, around the world, and, you know, and be able to distinguish different cultures and different periods and see how we have arrived at where we have arrived today.
And that places a really big burden on publishers.
Yes.
Okay, so yes. You can't just publish history books for children and hope they make you loads of money. You've got to publish stuff that's true to start with, or it's very obviously fiction, like Asterix or The Three Robbers.
Yeah.
But make them as playful as possible. And I would like to see books with flaps for adults. Yeah. I think I'd like pop-up books for adults. The sole... Oh, this modern thing in colouring books, right? You know, the kind of colouring in books and mindfulness. It's good that adults...
Are colouring in.
I think that's a great thing. Yep. And I don't see any difference with making kids, which are traditionally for children, books that are traditionally for children, for adults. I mean, that Castles book, I wanted to go through it and open up all the flaps. Yep. I'm not eight. Yeah. I'm 40.
Yeah.
You know, someone make me a book with flaps. Someone make me an adult pop-up book, please.
On what subject?
A rude one. No. Let's leave it there. That was the us thinking about books.
Children's books.
Children's history books. If you enjoyed us, please listen to our other episodes on how to be a historian and also our crazy chats about history of unexpected subjects. Like we've done the history of zombies and dragons and leaning, haven't we?
We have. And gloves and farts and toilets.
True. Very kids would like those ones.
Yeah.
You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell.
And you can follow Histories of the Unexpected at Unexpected Pod. We're proud to be part of the History Hit Podcast Network.
Yes, we certainly are.
And if you want to find out more about our show and other History Hit shows, go on to historyhit.com and you can find us at historyhit.com/unexpected. Bye!
Bye!
If you enjoy this podcast and you like learning about the past, check out my latest venture. It's called History Masterclass, and it's a new type of historical event where you can actually learn in person from the best historians around today in unique and stunning historical locations. You can find out more at thehistorymasterclass.com and follow on Facebook and Twitter at TheHistoryMC.